Podcasting is a complicated profession, which is why we're here to discuss Andor, currently airing on Disney+. My name is Dan Morin, and I am joined by my co-host, Tony Sindelar, is here. Hi, Tony.
Hello, nerds. Hello, Dan. Hello, soon-to-be-introduced third person.
Kat Benich is also here. Hi, Kat.
Hi, folks. I actually do not remember watching this show because I am so tired.
It's going to be a very special episode of A Complicated Profession where we're all creaky skeletons attempting to piece together a thing that we saw.
When we talked right here, Tony texted me. He's like, oh, we're going to have a podcast. And I was like, oh, I watched that. Wasn't that like a month ago? No, that was Wednesday? Yeah.
I have been doing the thing, this is the level of strategery I bring to my life, is that it's sad because I want to watch it on Wednesday, but we record on Saturday, and so I wait until Friday to watch it, and I avoid spoilers on the internet, but that means it's fresh in my brain.
It's really a 6 of 1, half dozen the other thing, right? Because either you remember it, or you get spoiled on it, and it's like, you gotta pick one or the other.
That's hard because we watched it in 10-minute increments. We're still... We started Lord of the Rings, too. Rings of Power last night at 7. We made it halfway through by 10 p.m.
I mean, it's because we pause and look up everything in Wikipedia, but no, it's not because of that. It's because there's a small child who demands to be acknowledged.
This podcast is really just a subversive advertisement for the importance of parental leave to make sure that we're getting sleep.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly why we're here. Well, we are also here to discuss episode 4 of season 1 of Andor, entitled Eldani. And Tony has volunteered to do, or at least everybody else took a step backwards. And Tony,
I was going to say, I don't think I actually volunteered. I think I was told. I was voluntold to do this.
You're very tired. You might not remember.
Yes. This is, you know, I just received my latest COVID booster, and I'm a little creaky from that. And I feel like I am almost, like, for a 24-hour period, living the Dan and Kat lifestyle of sleep deprivation. You know, it's just dipping into that, gaining some sympathy and empathy for what your life is like every day for the rest of your lives. So
I gotta go.
All right, so episode 4. So this episode is a bit of a turning point, and again, it feels like this makes sense that they released those first 3 episodes as a block, because in this episode we are going to get some new characters that seem like they're relatively important, and you know, things take a turn. Specifically, we get some scenes. I'm not giving you these in the order they happen in the show because my brain doesn't work that way, but we get some scenes on Coruscant at the Imperial Security Bureau.
Yep.
Yeah. And so they dress all in white, and they basically seem like they're kind of the CIA MI6 version of the Imperials, right? Sort of a lot. There's maybe with slightly more bureaucracy. We get several new characters introduced there. It seems like the most important of them is a character named
Dedra Mira.
Who is attempting to, it seems like there's repeated mentions to her career advancement. She is at odds with another Imperial Security Bureau bureaucrat played by Doc Brown. That's Lieutenant Supervisor Blevin, or because some of the actors on this are British, Lieutenant. And there's basically exciting fights about whose territory the events of the previous 3 episodes fall into. Blevin oversees the sector where Andor blew up a bunch of stuff, but the missing star drive thing is gives Miro a kind of, well, it doesn't work out, but that she thinks she has a claim to investigating it and figuring things out. So we are seeing a little bit of the bureaucracy, and you know, there's meetings in this episode, people. You love meetings.
Honestly, we just to cut in for a second, like, we talked about the whole thing about how do you request overtime in one of the first 3 episodes of again. This is showing how a bureaucratic empire would actually work. Did you report
or not?
Did you finish your quarterly report? I hear that, but did you do your reports on time? And are you staying within your budget? It's honestly, it's really fantastic.
Yes, wow. And I think we are getting. You know, to me, it's like it's the lining up with the. You know, there's the we have these meetings and it's all very formal and people are wearing very bright white uniforms, and we are cross-cutting between that and the rebellion basically planning a heist slash an assault on a garrison, and they are like camping in the woods and everything is dirty and a little damp, and there's space goats and
goats with extra horns stuck on
extra horns.
Bad idea.
Kind of reminded me of in Star Trek, the original series, when they would just like duct tape a horn onto a dog to make it a space alien. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So we have the Imperial plot happening. We have the where an investigation is happening. The Primor officers all get basically chewed out by Blevin, and seem like they're, I guess, are losing their jobs. We have a very short scene where ex-investigator Karn goes home and gets slapped in the face by his mom. But then perhaps the main action is Andor is being actively recruited into the into the rebellion, or at least as a mercenary
rebellion.
Level. Yeah, nascent rebellion. He's going to be operating under the name Clem for the next couple days. We have the interaction between Luther and Rail and this kind of rebel cell leader, where he's like, this is happening and I know you don't like it, but deal with it. And then she goes back to her group and she's like, this is happening and I know you don't like it, but deal with it. And you know, Andor is still shot up. We have the kind of we meet several characters in short sequence who are rebels on Aldani, and they seem to come from kind of very different walks of life. We have kind of like the idealists and like versus the very kind of cynical people, and the more military trained people versus, you know, kind of the kid. And it's, you know, there's a nice little cross section there. We don't really get a lot of time with them yet, but we get that they are planning this. They are going to steal the all the money from the garrison, the local garrison, I assume, basically so that the Empire can't make payroll. And Andor is going to get a bunch of money. It seems like the rest of them are doing it more for political, you know, terrorism type reasons. They have a Imperial lieutenant who pulls up on a speeder bike, who is their kind of their inside man. I guess the other thread in this episode, we get a little bit more time with Stellan Skarsgård's character, Luthen Rail, where we see that he maintains at least one cover identity, but I think there's the implication he might have a couple, because he's got a cool spy cabinet full of disguises, and one of his covers is that he is like an antique dealer on Coruscant, and he meets with Mon Mothma, who will later be an important leader in the rebellion. But this is back when she is still actively a senator. She is married to another senator, and like the walls seem to be closing in on Mon Mothma in terms of she's being like actively surveilled, and like you know, there's the implication that like the driver that she has been assigned is spying on her, and so on. That was a very meandering recap. Did I miss any major plot threads in there?
I think those are the big threads. I mean, I enjoyed watching these things get a little more tied together. I thought in particular, I really enjoyed the Luthen Mon Mothma interactions.
Yeah.
We get the whole tension of the spy thing there, right? Like her driver might be spying on her. They have to like distract him so that they can pretend to go in the back and talk about something.
Coins?
Yeah. Ooh, look at these fancy, shiny coins. Poor driver guy. And that it seems like she is basically bankrolling the rebellion.
By skimming, though, off, not with her money, but like the money seems like it's coming from elsewhere.
It's unclear. She has accounts, but it sounds like it's just harder for her to move stuff around.
Yeah. But also, taking a step back, right? How does this finance system work? Because if they're able to steal the actual sector's payroll, that implies it's in hard currency rather than in
transactions. Right?
Yeah. So I guess they don't pay stormtroopers. They don't all have bank accounts. So it's a largely unbanked population. It raises questions about how this works.
Yeah. No, I mean, we saw a little bit of the banks were covered a little bit in Clone Wars, right? Because there's a Padme's friend who like works for the banks, her ex-boyfriend or whatever, in like one arc. But yeah, they don't really, I mean, I don't think they go into it much. None of them have chain codes. That's the problem.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of hand-waving about how this financial system works, but I'm expecting in the next series to get a deep dive in the financial system of the Empire.
I mean, I think there's the, I mean, I remember in Clone Wars, there's this segment where Darth Maul becomes basically a space pirate, and he's just ripping off crates worth of credit. So it does seem like hard currency is still a big thing, in which doesn't make any sense in space. I mean, I assume probably if you're not connected to the Empire, you don't trust the, yeah, the banking systems, right? If you're on the outer rim, you're unbanked. But I think we see that in the Mandalorian too. It seems like hard currency in the form of those little metal chips whatever they are, like a big deal.
If the banks didn't really cooperate off plans. Anyways, I digress. I agree that it's interesting that somehow she's bankrolling, but she's struggling to get the money, and they're also looking to bring someone else in, which is interesting.
Yeah, we were running some theories on that. I was guessing that was
Senator Bail Organa.
I thought that too. As well.
I didn't think so, because I feel like Dan sent me a great article. I forget, we should mention where that was from, because it was really fun. Just look through all the Easter eggs. But as I recall, in The Revenge of the Sith, Bail Organa and Mon Mothma are already working together in a deleted scene. Mm.
Correct.
So a deleted scene, so take it for what it's worth. But I feel like Bail Organa would have, from what we saw in Obi-Wan, Bail Organa is already connected to the Rebellion. Mm-hmm. So I don't think they're looking to bring him in. I think they're going to look to bring in someone else.
We're about 5 years still out from Battle of Yavin, not to spoil other properties, but we do know from Rebels, which is probably a year or two after this, mm-hmm, that Bail Organa is already playing an instrumental part in the Rebellion. Yeah. And certainly by the time of Rogue One, which is, of course, just before Episode 4, he is deeply involved. It's unclear, but it also is possible. I think what we're seeing a lot, and they talk about this a couple times in the episode, and I think we've discussed this as well, like all of the separate branches, like the Rebellion is very decentralized and very disorganized right now, because there's a bunch of different factions.
And for safety too, I think that was the whole thing we saw with Gargard's character, is trying to maintain the cells so they don't know about each other, so they can't betray each other.
Right. And then at the same time, you also have people like Saw Gerrera and other people who are kind of doing their own thing. And like, not everybody's necessarily on the same page with this. And so maybe it's possible that, you know, Organa is involved in like a different segment of the Rebellion and hasn't been brought in to maybe like, oh, we are on the ground, like doing stuff right now. And then we have Luthen, too, who is an interesting character, because is he an idealist? Is he a go-between? Is he, you know, just there to get paid and, like, sort of facilitate stuff? We don't really know. His pitch to Cassian certainly seems like, I'm in this fight. You know, you want to be in this fight, too. But he also seems like the kind of guy
who is very slippery, though.
Right. He knows how to pitch people, right? He knows how to tell everybody what they want to hear. Because he tells him, he like offers him money, and then later on, you realize nobody else is getting paid.
Which is fascinating, but I think that's like to get Cassian Andor in, to get him.
Exactly.
In, obviously, to get in the first one to get paid, and then you realize that actually the cause is much bigger. Well, I think we're going to probably talk later in this episode about what we think is going to come next. But I will say, I think one of my favorite moments in the entire episode is when he puts on his purple cape, and again, capes are back, and does his little sort of like getting into character, like finds the body language and sort of like does the finger guns to himself and then walks off the ship. Such a great moment.
Yeah, that's good. And also, I had that moment where during some of the trailers, I'd noticed there were scenes with him with longer hair, and I was like, well, maybe there's time jumps and he just changes his hair. And I was like, oh no, just a wig. he's gonna slap on, which I love, because it's like, it doesn't actually change his appearance that much.
No.
And yet, but it kind of works, right? It's like subtle spycraft, which I enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
The theatricality to it. So we have that whole subplot, which I thought was great. There are apparently a number of Easter eggs in his shop, including I think there's some Mandalorian stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mandalorian stuff. Lots of references to previous video games, potentially Indiana Jones whip and carbonite.
Tony, I don't know if you saw this, but he also apparently makes reference to something from Knights of the Old Republic.
Yes, when he gives him that kyber crystal, he references Knights of the alien species of Knights of the Old Republic.
I never finished, but and then there was also apparently something from the Force Unleashed game. Holocrons potentially were in the shop too.
Do you want to say where this
article comes from? denofgeek.com.
You can find it.
You can find it, or we'll put a link in the show note. Anyways, lots of little references to various things. So that's, you know, we sort of have that element of what's going on. And then we also have the... You look like you...
Well, so, we want to keep staying on the sort of the Mon Mothma... If we stay sort of on Coruscant first and sort of talk that before we go back to the Sheep Rebellion, I did think it was interesting... What was... Other than sort of seeing the import-export job with the antiques, I think I was actually quite surprised that Mon Mothma is not in... It was an interesting choice to have her in a challenging relationship with her husband. That there's a lot of friction there. It seemed unhealthy. And then even the very end, as she's walked down accusing him of basically siding with her the senators who are essentially cutting off shipping lanes and starving a population to a form of protest. Of just, it was an interesting choice. I would have expected, I guess, we didn't know she had a husband. That was, I think, and then the decision to put her, so not only is she can't trust anyone around her, but even within her own household, she can't trust her husband because he's clearly not in it, I think just adds layers upon layers of the stress and intrigue that she is operating under.
And I liked that relationship because what was interesting about it, and Tony, you mentioned that he was also a senator. I'm not sure if that, is that true? Is he a senator? Is
maybe
he just...
I just inferred that because he was inviting, like, basically, like, we're having a dinner with your political rival, who are my old friends.
Well, he just seems like the kind of, it's like, I think this is a very interesting, it's sort of a gender flip role, right? You would think of like in an older movie where you had a more traditional gender roles, you would have the male senator and the wife would be like the social hostess or whatever. And it seems like, I think they flipped it here. It's like, he struck me as like, he's just into, you know, he wants to have a good time. He's there to enjoy the finer things in life.
We talked about how he wants it with the fun people at this my side of the table.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I love that sort of dynamic where he's like, oh, you're always working. I want to have fun and socialize with these people and, you know, get drunk at our dinner parties. And I kind of enjoyed that dynamic. I also want to mention the actor who plays him, because it jumped. This is a guy, Alistair McKenzie, who I knew as the lead on a show called Monarch of the Glen like 20 years ago, which I thought was, I staring at this guy and be like, why do I know this guy's face? Also, the another character from that, or another actor from that show showed up on, is in major part in Rings of Power. So they're doing okay for themselves, that show.
Tony, good. I heard them. A lot about Monarch of the Glen after watching this episode. Oh, a lot great. About Monarch of the Glen.
All right, it's just me. Fine.
I was wondering, so they mentioned the planet that they are from or that they're representing is
Chandrila.
Chandrila,
which is...
I didn't recognize that. Is that a common...
That is Mon Mothma's... That is where she is from in Canada.
Okay. We haven't seen...
No.
We haven't gotten there. Okay.
No, yeah. Except though, it did mention that I believe Chandrila is in canon the capital of the New Republic after the Empire falls. And I was wondering if that's what we saw destroyed in the first movie.
It's not. They changed some stuff.
Okay.
Like at one point, certainly in extended universe, I think it was the... No, of course, it's actually the capital.
Yeah,
that's right.
Says Disney. It said in that article. This is
Yeah.
Our listener show is like, I have no idea. This is, I have not read any of the new books, but skipping other articles. We're doing some real time Google.
I'm just looking at Wikipedia because you know these things. I mean, I knew it has long been the like sort of the home of Mon Mothma.
Yeah,
apparently, in some cases, the Galactic Senate. The New Republic's Galactic Senate was first established in Chandrila.
I assume that's being picked up in the books. That
comics,
is actual books.
It looks like,
But yeah, no, that was that. But that I had heard before. But I don't think we'd actually ever seen much about the culture other than there's the planet being named, or at least I was not familiar with that.
No, I don't think in certainly in modern canon, and even in the EU, I don't think we see too much of it.
Oh, I just want to also admire the costuming of Mon Mothma is excellent. Just the costuming all throughout, just showing, we talked pretty what they did with the what's the planet casting from?
Canary.
Their costumes, and again showing sort of the devolution, and then Mon Mothma's of just the beautiful, I don't know what to call that, art deco or something, just the sweeping angles and just showing the different cultures on the different planets with very, very different costumes. You see that too with the Sheep Rebellion, of like the feels like very natural fabrics.
Yeah, I thought with Mon Mothma in particular, the white links her visually to the, you know, classic look of that character, but also in a way that is much more elegant and chic
and
than I think that way.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Before it was just a 1970s sheet that was very like faucet. yeah, no, this was very excellent. Just again, using her costume to act, sort of when she walks back into the limo and opens up the collar just to show again, I think Jay, you said like the noose around her neck, that things are tightening.
All right, should we jump over to the jungle rebellion, rebellion, Scottish rebellion? I think they're in Scotland.
The last it looks like the Scottish Islands. It's very green, very damp.
The last thing I say about the action we saw in Coruscant, I did think it was interesting. We did see the character from Corporate Sec, the deputy inspector, and him going back to see, realize he's from Coruscant. He's
we
from
assumed that was Coruscant. We I don't think it's.
Oh, I wasn't sure where that was. Yeah, I mean, giant.
It looked like it. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, giant housing block kind of thing, right? Where he's taking the elevator way down and then walking through corridors.
Yeah, going back to the lower level, so coming from the lower level to Coruscant, and then I think his mother being both upset and happy to see him. I think, again, really interesting what they're doing with that character. You now understand a little more of his motivation about why he joined corporate security, of trying to prove himself and trying to come up in society, maybe why he couldn't join the Empire. I don't know if, like,
he's got flat feet.
I don't know if it's something like the similar to, you know, the British Naval Empire, like where you had to buy commission to get in. He just didn't know enough people to get something other than a stormtrooper. And so I don't think that's the last we're going to see of that character. But it was a very interesting, it was like what we saw, 30 seconds of him, dropped him, but very clearly we're going to see more of him. But I think even that 30 seconds, they really did a nice bit of character building.
Yeah, well, he gets in his scene where he gets chewed out too. And I felt so bad for his boss, who is complicit, but at the same time, it's just like, I wasn't even supposed to be here. Like,
but I didn't have the salmon mousse.
So, yeah, well, last we'll see of that guy probably, but probably not Karn. All right, let's move to the rebellion in the Highlands. So, as we mentioned, Luthen drops off Cassian with a how do you do? After trying to give him the hard sell on joining the rebellion and then being like, well, all right, what if I pay you $200,000? Which is a lot. And we meet Vel, who is the leader of this little particular cell. If you thought she looked familiar, which I did, she was on Game of Thrones. She is the other inductee at the House of Faces with the assassins who torments Arya a whole bunch. I was like, that face is very distinct, like the sort of sharp chiseled features. And then we also meet a bunch of other people with a lot of sci-fi names that I could not keep straight. But, you know, various degrees of fresh-faced youth who is very welcoming, more skeptical, sort of rangy looking dude with who just is skeptical of everybody, and maybe more of a gunslinger type, the young woman who is like their medic, etc., which I thought was a fun, as you mentioned, a fun cross-section of people who have, you know, very different discussions. They're also, I liked the implication from Luthen that, like, this is such a loose organization, and like clearly he makes a point to Vel about, like, you want to be taken seriously as the leader, so you have to like lay down the law. And it's clear that like maybe they had been operating a little bit more like a loosey, like a democracy. Well, let's vote on this. And it's like, no, you can't run a cell.
Let's come to consensus. Yeah.
So I enjoyed that sort of the evolving structure of the rebellion with like, yep, you got to have a leader, and that leader needs to make hard decisions and sometimes sell decisions that are not hers. And also that nobody else in the cell seems to know Luthen exists.
Yeah. Nope.
Well, again, that goes back to the fact that I think they're keeping all the cells disconnected.
Compartmentalized.
Yeah. Exactly. But it was...
I like the kind of sudden kind of tone shift to like, now you're in a war movie, right? Now this is like the Dirty Dozen. She's like, we're sleeping on rocks and eating roots, and it's like, things don't look great, right? You know, it's
And we have a very complex plan for this heist that seems like, oh, nothing could go wrong. I appreciate that they're building D&D maps to run their run their heist.
Some parts are delicate.
Because the ring gets in. Again, I love the full credit to the scriptwriter and the director and producer of just bring little things like that, the reality of like, it's pouring rain. Your glue is not going to dry, so your miniatures will not fully work.
And I've done a lot of camping in my day, and I was definitely like, yep, I've been there, sitting in the rain. You can't do much, and everything's damp, and you're just trying to stay not, you know, completely waterlogged, and it's like, and they're just waiting for this, you know, this I guess astronomical thing that's going to be their cover for their heist, and they're just sitting in the rain waiting, and it's like, it's kind of miserable.
And it's, I think, fascinating too, I think too, is sort of the scene where they're all sitting around eating dinner, and Cassian gets handed basically three manuals, told to memorize them. He's like, but can I have dinner? But I think he currently feels like there's nowhere else he can go. And I do think, what the, Rathan? The leader who wore the purple.
Mm-hmm.
Stelsgard. Luthen. Yeah, Luthen. Thank you. Luthen. Really had Cassian's number by, the promise of the money keeps him there, even though it's a pretty horrible situation. Because he's just getting, he showed up, it's pouring rain, no one likes him. He's going to go do a suicide mission, and he doesn't even get to finish dinner. That sounds pretty awful.
But he's going to get paid.
And I think because he got the Kyber Crystal, he knows the money is good, right?
Right. There's the promise of money, right, where he tells him, this is worth 50K, but I'll always pay more for it. So, like, if you,
yeah,
you know, it's within your interest to come back and, like, give it to me rather than just sell it off and run.
So they do a nice job of, like, why would Cassian do this? Right, what would get him to join the rebellion, and some nice thinking about how his motivations would actually work out in that scene.
And I think, Kat, you made a great point when we were watching this, about, we still have this open-ended question of why Cassian has been recruited.
Oh yeah, why all this effort for this one guy? Like, couldn't they have found a pilot somewhere else? Or Cassian doesn't seem too special at this point. He just seems a little, I don't know.
They seem, there's some desperation there, right? And I, you know, I get the sense that they've got this small group, and how competent are they? There is that kind of thing where it's like, how big a deal is a pilot? Mainly because everybody we know in Star Wars is a pilot, right? You know,
is it like driving a car, or is it?
Yeah, you know, because Luke is an amazing pilot, and Han's an amazing pilot, and Rey's an amazing pilot, and so we know lots of pilots, and so it's like, how big a deal is it that he can pilot a ship? None of you can do that, but apparently none of them can do that for whatever reason.
Well, they mentioned that he's a, like, redundancy, right? Like, so he has skills that they all have, and he can kind of, if somebody goes down, essentially their point is he can fill any role. He's a utility infielder, if you'll excuse the baseball parlance.
I have no idea what that means, but that's fine. Here's my liberal headcanoning. I think that Luthen has seen something in Cassian, and he, you know, he thinks that this job is just the way to get, you know, it's not so much that he needs Cassian for this job, but he sees this job as like a test, an entry point for him to do more for the rebellion, or whatever we want to call
basically,
it.
He's basically like, a talent scout.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess the thing, your point about desperation, like, in looking back to all of Cassian's friends and family on Ferrix, maybe it is really hard to find that balance of desperation and willingness to join something where not only would you be killed, but maybe your entire family would be killed as well, and actual competence.
And let's not forget, there's a lever there as well, right? Because he knows that he's from Canary, I think, and knows that he's got the background of that planet, and knows that he has, not exactly the malleability, but knows he's like, he's pissed off about the Empire, right? Like, there's a lever there. If you're recruiting, you're like, oh, I want to find a way to motivate you to do this. And he knows that, like you said, the money's the entry point, but he also knows that this guy is just very angry and wants to do damage. And that is a valuable asset to, like, convert someone to your cause.
But there might be a lot of people who, there are like that, who are, there's clearly, but it's got to be that Venn diagram, right?
Exactly.
There's got to be a lot of angry people, but may not have the skills the rebellion needs. There are people that have the skills the rebellion needs, but may not be desperate enough. And then they also said he's willing to kill if need to be.
Yeah,
and
that seems, right.
I mean, Luthen has seen firsthand how they got out of that situation. And I get the sense that maybe these other people, at least in this cell, you know, like, they're motivated, but maybe they haven't actually had to do anything yet, right? And I'm a little bit reminded of like the rebels in the Rebel show, where, you know, they're like stealing crates, right? And then it's like, well, are we ready to, like, you know, they're like hijinks, right? And they're like, haha, waving at the stormtroopers, they fly away with their crate full of food or crate full of credits or whatever, right? And it's like, he knows that this is a guy who, you know, killed two people in an alley, right? He knows that this is, I mean, we got a little bit, some cryptic messages to, like, possibly was a child soldier. Sounds like he was, we know he was in prison, right? He is hardened in a way that perhaps none of the other people in that cell are. I mean, I guess I'm especially, they've got, like, what, five people? And one of them is that kid that fell asleep on watch, right? So I think they're a little desperate.
They're not skimming the cream of the crop, right? Like, this is like, you know, again, sorry to go back to the baseball metaphor, but it's like finding the promising, you know, a high school draftee who you're like, oh man, this kid can hit and pitch, and like, we need that.
And like, under pressure, right? That's the thing, is I think under pressure, he stays cool, calm, and collected, and does what needs to be done, right? I guess, So maybe I recant in a previous statement. I guess I can understand why Cassian might be actually quite a rare find, and why you would want to recruit
him. And look at the, by contrast, look at everybody else on Ferrix.
Well, that's what I was trying to say.
When the Primor showed up, everybody ran, right? Like, everybody, they did the thing with the intimidation and banging the stuff, but like, nobody was going to stand up against them, right? There was nobody inciting that crowd to be like, let's push back, right? They're all like, we just don't want trouble, right?
We don't want
trouble. It's like the Western town where the, you know, the shops all close up and everybody, you know, runs back inside.
And that's where I think we will potentially see, I mean, we see that with Corpsec going after Marva, is they're not, when they have retribution, they won't just go after you, they'll go after your family. So again, the stakes are high for rebelling, I think is a fair assumption. So it's, so I can see again why he's unique. That being said, it seems like Luthen knows a lot about Cassian, right? Because had that great line of, I fought on Minbom, which I believe is the planet that we saw in Solo when Han Solo's fighting in the...
when he meets Chewie.
And they said they're fighting each other, so I don't really know we don't know, I think, a lot about what conflict we're actually seeing on that planet. But then Luthen's just like, you signed up as a cook and you're there for 6 months. So, like... Don't give me that.
So what you're saying is he's running for the House of Representatives in Ohio. I thought that was interesting too. Like there's a lot of, and maybe part of it is like, you know, he can pull the records and has access to see, like, again, if you're looking for a pool of talented people, you have a giant galaxy. How do you start narrowing it down? And so finding people who have maybe Imperial experience, who were in prison, like, these are like, you know, show that they have skills, they have drive, they have all this stuff. Yeah. So I think, again, it really does work for me as the analogy of a talent scout, him looking for people like, who can I find and recruit that is going to make a big difference to our cause and maybe bring some skills and experience that we don't have otherwise. But yeah, that's it's a good question. I think there may be still another shoe left to drop there, because I don't think, again, as I said up top, I don't think we entirely understand Luthen's relationship or place in this, but I'm interested to know more.
Yeah, I mean, he's got this fancy ship with his droid and his spy cabinet full of wigs and rings and whatnot. I mean, I assume that being a power broker for the rebellion seems way too risky to be doing for profit. I guess it just seems like there's got to be easier ways to make a buck. But you know, I mean, it's interesting that even, like, you know, one of his identities seems to be a relatively fancy, rich, well-off person on Coruscant. It takes
money to set that all up, right? You don't run like a fancy art gallery without some currency to back it. So
I assume those are all real products, right? He's not selling fakes. It's got
to
be
and it seems like he is operating at tremendous risk to himself, right? So I don't know. I mean, I think he's very slippery. Like I feel like every time, I mean, we only ever see him talking to people that he's trying to get something from, right? Be it Andor or Mon Mantha or something. And so there's a lot of telling people what, you know, maybe he thinks they need to hear from him. So I am interested to see where we go more with that. Should we talk more about our Imperial friends that we met this episode?
Yes.
Or coworkers.
It's interesting. So we have ISB, which we've never seen in a lot of depth before. It's been explored in expanded universe stuff, mm-hmm. and kind of back. What's the word? Retconned into existence in like A New Hope, with the Colonel Yularen at the conference table in the Death Star. There's like one guy with a white uniform, and it's been retconned to be like this particular character, who works for ISB. They're much more of, from what we can tell here, they're like a military intelligence branch, right?
Because
they don't.
So was Agent Callus in Rebels ISB because he's an agent?
That's a good
question.
He
had a funny outfit.
I assume so.
Because he doesn't wear he has that stupid hat. It doesn't look like anyone else's helmet.
Oh, yeah.
The one that perfectly covers his sideburns.
Sideburns are not regulation.
He was an ISB agent. Yep.
Okay. Mainly because he is his title is agent, not something military sounding, right? Like lieutenant or corporal or something like that. And there are also frequently times where it seems like he is kind of to the side of the Imperial military, right? Like he's clearly, he has a voice, but he is not part of the chain of command,
boss,
right?
Yeah.
Kind of in a way, I mean, it seemed a little bit like internal affairsy in terms of his role, because I think, but mainly just because he was assigned to be rooting out moles in
he did work in both the internal affairs branch and the investigations branch of the Bureau, according to Wikipedia.
Thank you, Wikipedia.
You're welcome.
Okay, so this is our most time we've spent with ISB. We see their fancy headquarters. We see their giant meetings with everyone in white. We see what their office politics are like.
And there's like, there's a high degree, as Kat said, above the bureaucracy here, right? Like fulfilling your reports and writing memos. And also we have that bit about like, where the major in charge is like, what is our purpose here? Like the textbook question.
We are in healthcare.
Yes, exactly. Which I enjoyed. That is Anton Lesser, who again, people might recognize from Game of Thrones as, he's the Meister who makes the mountain.
Oh, he's
immortal.
The evil one.
He's the evil Meister.
The spooky Meister.
Yeah,
who's
spooky
into
Meister.
Black arts.
And Kat and I
necromancy.
Kat and I know and love from the British TV show Endeavor, where he plays a high-ranking police officer who is just kind of a delight.
Yeah.
A crusty old guy, but has a heart of gold.
I love Anton Lesser. He is one of my favorite actors.
Fantastic. It's when we keep casting people from England, it's a small island. you're going to get some repeats. Everyone here, I just assume everyone here has either been in a Harry Potter, in a Game of Thrones, and or in
Downton
a Doctor Who, right? Yeah. One of those. Yeah.
Possibly all of them. Yes,
and all of them had a one episode part on EastEnders, I'm sure.
I enjoyed that. I like the look at the bureaucracy, and I like the introducing the frustrations. We can see people jockeying for power. I think this is going to lead to, it doesn't seem like this is the kind of thing that Miro's going to let go. She seems to be, Blevins keeps accusing her of being like a ladder climber, basically.
And I think she's something else. I think
she's like a zealot, or perhaps just a, by the book sort of like, and they mentioned that they recruited her from like law enforcement or something.
They recruited her?
I couldn't
remember. Is that what it was?
Yeah, I think so. Because they were like, oh, we don't, you're from the outside, essentially. We recruited you to bring like the kind of experience that we don't have. But it seems like, that's like the...
There's
a
culture clash.
Right. And it's like the cop movies where it's like, I'm a loose cannon, but I get results.
Well, I think what we were specifically supposed to be getting at, I feel like that the speech about what do we do was like, to me, it's like that is the paired with Andor's speech about like, they're fat and lazy and you walk in like you belong there, you spit in their food and you take what you want, right? I feel like those two speeches go in contrast to each other. But there is this thing here where it's like they are preoccupied with like, have you done your report on time versus has anything actually happened
is
of
there
substance?
A real threat?
Right. And it seems like Miro sees a real threat, right? And there's the thing where she gets chewed out for trying to hone in on the other guy's case. And she's like, I see this pattern. And she doesn't have the facts ready, or she doesn't have her argument ready, but it's like she sees that the rebellion is coming and they chew her out because it's like, well, what are you, what's your proof, right? What's your evidence?
Yeah, you know, she's right, but for the wrong reasons. She like, yeah, she has something like, where she's figured it out, but she doesn't have all the pieces yet.
Yeah.
And I am wondering, just thinking about TV and how things go, I am feeling like Miro and Karn might be on some kind of collision course, team up course, something, but because they're both kind of true believers. They're not just collecting a paycheck, right?
Well, she was trying to get all the deep files, so I think what she might do, like, you can measure, like, did you know that the deputy inspector was on this case, is here on Coruscant, you can go around Blevins by just going to talk to him, something along those lines. I also found it interesting, I was thinking at the first, when she was trying to track down that unit that
the Starpath unit.
Unit, thank you, that Cassie was trying to sell. I originally thought that she was perhaps trying to cover up something because she seemed so keen on finding it, had it been stolen from her sector. But that belief was quickly jettisoned when she was then open about it later with others. Of just, I think she's very much someone who wants to cross her T's and dot her I's, and
she wants things done right.
Yes.
It's not whereas it feels like, and she is creating friction with a bureaucracy where it's like, you know, just check the box and move on, right? That doesn't work for her, right?
I think it's because it goes back to what Cassie was saying about the speeches being paired. They are so focused on the reports because they can't imagine there being a real threat.
Like, yes.
Yeah. The real threat comes from if we don't do our reports on time and we haven't governed correctly, not that there could be...
The emperor and his lackey who strangle people if you don't do your reports right. Like, let's worry about that. This ragtag band.
I think there's definitely a belief in bureaucracy of, like, if you follow the rules and you do all the reports and everything will hum perfectly along. Mm. Not even believing that not everyone plays by the same rules as you do.
But it seems like she is, as you said, Tony, on a path to maybe, like, being the one who's starting to ferret out there's something going on here. Speaking of that, though, let's speaking of ferrets, where we're expecting this to go in the next couple weeks, to me this is kind of a hinge episode, right? Because it moves Cassian along to the next stage of the plot. I think next week is the heist.
I think
that ends with whatever complication will happen, right? Like, oh no, there's more than 40 guys. Oh no, our ship isn't fast enough, and that's our cliffhanger.
I think people are going to die, right? I mean, I look at those and I was like, not all these guys at this campsite are coming back. sorry.
But I'm looking forward to seeing the heist in action and like having, I mean, because we had some action at the end of episode 3, but like, it is definitely a show that simmers a lot more than it goes to an open boil.
And it doesn't genre hop, right? Because we had a heist 2 in Mandalorian. And I feel like that every time they did sort of a different episode, they adopted the feel of that genre. I don't think this is going to be sort of a fun, happy heist.
No. It feels
like
you said Dirty Dozen before, Tony, which does strike me as about the right tone for this. You know, something that's gritty, and I mean, it had amusement in it, but it is like a gritty, like,
this is not Ocean's 11.
No, right. Exactly.
No.
And I wanted to point out, I don't think we talked about this last week as much, but like the production stuff, I know we talked about a little bit, like a lot of this is shot on location rather than on the volume.
It's beautiful.
Clearly shot. I don't know where I was looking.
It looked like Scotland.
It looked a heck like Scotland.
Yeah.
And
somewhere green and wet and, you know, for some value is beautiful.
But also at the same time,
as long as you're not the one camping out there,
the way it's all shot, like, you know, Mandalorian and Book of Boba Fett, Obi-Wan even, all had, I think, very similar cinematographic styles.
I would agree.
This feels very different. It does. Especially last week with the you know, the fight at the end. It's on the ground mostly. It's close up. It's shaky cam. You know, like, it feels more like Rogue One to me, for one. It's clearly shot very similar to Rogue One, but also a lot of, I mean... Again, Tony Gilroy, the Bourne movies, you know, it's got a similar sort of aesthetic to a lot of that. Stuff is dark and muted. You don't have bright colors. You don't have shiny stuff, right? Stuff is much more dinged up than even in the, you know, Mandalorian.
Yeah. It is. It's very different from the Star Wars movies, frankly, aside from Rogue One. I mean, I feel like their relationship with violence and their relationship with how violence and action are depicted, it's not like these celebrations of explosions. It's like violence is, you know, brutal and close and scary, right? And yeah, lots of, you know, lots of close in on things, and I don't know, yeah, things seem extra dirty and sad and wet. So
that's kind of like, I like the similar to Rogue One, I think we mentioned too, the color palette, the why I find the white of both Mon Mothma and the ISB so striking, because Ferrix is so dirty, and then the greens of Aldani, again, very evocative to the planet where Jin grew up. To me, again, those same green tones. So yeah, I think they've done a nice job following that. And then I think what else we mentioned, wanted to talk to last podcast was the editing. The editing is really good. So in the last three episodes, the last one, they're jumping back and forth between the past and the present, was flawlessly done. And here too, I think, again, just really nice, sharp editing that just is very pleasing to have they do it. It feel like it makes a statement, and I can't think of an example right now from the most recent episode, but again, just really nice cut that I think really
this was episode. You know, this was the longest episode at 50 minutes, which I thought was interesting because we had an episode as short as 38, so that's a big swing in time. I feel like the editing and the pacing is so kind of perfect, where things do not feel rushed. But there's also not kind of any, like, things don't sag. And so it's like you get to the end of the 50 minutes and it, you know, they cut, you know, he gets his, like, spy homework. And then the episode ends and I'm like, that's it? And it's like, that was 50 minutes. And it's like, you had me hooked the whole time in a way that, like, a lot of 40-minute shows do not.
You know? It doesn't meander at all in this episode. Everything is kind of spare and with purpose.
It's weird because it does not move at a breakneck pace, but it is like it, but it also doesn't sag, right? So
because they're doing character development, right. I think, which is really nice.
Yeah. And I think a lot of what they
taught,
I think a lot of what they deal with is tension and tension heightened scenes without open conflict. When you have that scene with Stellan Skarsgård and Mon Mothma in the back room and they're talking and they're like, okay, we need the money, and but the guy outside might be listening, like. It's not a scene of fisticuffs, but you're like, it's an edge of your seat sort of thing.
And
like,
it's
way tenser than
a battle, right? I'd much rather see everyone sneaking around because you know it's going to come. You know it's going to come. And
longer this is a 50
you
minute...
wait for it, it doesn't come.
Yeah, and this is a 50-minute episode with not any action set pieces in it, but it's just like, it's these tense conversations. It's a series of conversations, but they're all, you know, tense and well done, right? You know,
that's probably the hallmarks of the spy thriller genre to me. Like that I feel like that is kind of what it does in spades, and it's cool to see it imported here and used to really great effect.
But it requires a very good script and very good editing to pull it off, because otherwise it's just boring.
Yep. And honestly, it's fascinating too. We talked about this a little bit last week as well, but the lack, even though it has all these Easter eggs and stuff that do tie into the larger canon, A, none of them really matter, and B, it does, I think, benefit from, as we discussed, you know, having a creative team that was perhaps not as deep into the Star Wars fandom and lore as some of the other shows, and that kind of works in favor of this particular show, because it doesn't want to glamorize thing, right? Like, it doesn't sort of play up the, you know, things that we have seen before. You know, aliens or robots or whatever. It is sort of just taking a cue from the tone and working with that. And I think that continues to be the case here, right? Like, you know, even though they're all those little Easter eggs in the shop and whatever, like, none of that matters if you miss it. And I missed most of them.
Doesn't matter at all.
doesn't impact the plot. Yeah.
They don't feel the need in the way, you know, I think Solo is perhaps the movie the most maligned for it, where it's like they put those front and center in the middle of the scene, right?
Yeah, let's linger the camera on them,
Yeah, they're content to put them over in the margin. And I think that, you know, I don't know. I enjoy some fan service, but it quickly becomes a little much. And this is a show where it's like, we'll put that there. It's there if you want it, but we don't. That's not why we're here. That's not part of the story.
Mon Mothma is not going to drop a wizard at the end of any scene.
Yeah, yeah.
So that would be pretty.
You
awesome.
Don't know that. I don't it could know happen. That. It's a wizard dinner party, man. All right. Any other thoughts?
I'm interested. So think back to the trailers. The two characters that we have yet to see that I recall in the trailers is Saw Gerrera, and then yep. I believe the actor is Ben Miles.
Oh yeah, Ben Miles. Yeah,
that's so I think with that clearly we're they even mentioned Saw Gerrera in the episode, so clearly we're gonna go to about. I'm intrigued to see where both of those take us. Right, Saw Gerrera clearly means we will see the more
partisans.
Yeah, the partisans who are more open to violence. And then Ben Miles' character means we're going to see more political intrigue, I believe, on Coruscant. And my current hunch is he might be the one they want to bring in, because also that means he's a character who we can then kill off later. just to be completely a sort of Machiavellian about
it. The Gerrera angle, I think, is interesting, too, because you can quickly see how you might have people like Luthen and Mon Mothma worried that they could lose Cassian to that side of the cause, but like, oh, but that's... We need somebody who's good at violence, but like doesn't like it too much.
Or that split may not have happened yet either.
Mm-hmm. Or that could be the case. Because it seems like, you know, I can't remember if they explicitly discuss him having history with Saw Gerrera in Rogue One. I mean, they send Jin for a reason because she has like a background with him.
Yeah.
But like, it kind of feels like Cassian's like, you know, maybe they've had dealings in the past and like, he's not going to listen to me. Like, we have... something happened or whatever. So I'm kind of interested to see how those characters relate.
I'm interested. I mean, I like, you know, we've seen Saw Gerrera. I guess we've seen him in live action. We've seen him in animation and we've seen him in video games. And, you know, I think a little bit of him can go a long way. I kind of like the version of him in the video game Fallen Order where like basically there's a part of the game that takes place on Kashyyyk. And it's like, he's there leading the group. And like, I mean, I think even the story is basically like he drops in there, helps do some really violent stuff to like help the Wookiees, and then he's gone to like the next thing he's off to, right?
Yeah.
So he is like, you could see how he could kind of just but he could just kind of barrel into a story, turn everything upside down, and then he's off.
He's out,
right? Because he's off to the next battlefield, right?
Yeah.
He does not put down roots and he goes wherever he can have kind of the biggest impact, right? You know, and he is he's not someone who's going to be planning a heist. He's someone who shows up.
Yeah, they just they blow up
sets
the
up. You know, he would not be waiting 3 days for the cover. He would be, you know, we just blow everything up and then we leave, right?
On that too, it is interesting to show sort of where we are. You guys, I think, said this earlier, and I think just really clicked with me now, that the two fundamental things we're seeing the Rebellion do right now are both related to raising funds. One, the interaction with Martha is getting money, and two, hitting payroll is getting money to fuel the Rebellion.
I keep getting texts from them all the time, like, please send us money. It's like, Jesus, Rebellion, take it easy.
But yeah, to really say what stage of the Rebellion they're at now.
Well, and it's also funny because it's something that I think we haven't, to your point about like finances and whatever, like we haven't really dealt with that. But like, how do you fund a Rebellion, right? Like they need, they eventually have like a base full of ships, right? Like of like, basically imagine that you had a Rebellion that's like, we got a bunch of F-16s that we found, bought, what? Like,
Well, they you know, Dan, they were gifts from the U.S. government.
They fell off the back of a bulk freighter. I mean, I think there's an interesting point to that. Like, how do you deal with funding and how do you hit the Empire in a way that hurts it when you're dealing with this gigantic monolithic organization? Like, it feels like a pretty big deal to take out the payroll for a sector. Is it? We don't really know. How many sectors are there? Is this a big sector? Is there a lot of payroll? We don't really understand all of that. But like, I kind of intrigued in that aspect too, right? Like, because Luthen's whole pitch is like, let's hit them where it hurts. And it's like, what if it turns out that's not enough, right? And you need to take it further. So I think that's an interesting distinction as well that Saw Gerrera could play into, right? Because he'd be like, I don't want to rob anybody. Like, that's not going to hurt him. I want to do destruction, right?
Yeah, Saw Gerrera would want to assassinate the leader of the garrison or something, right?
I also wanted to mention briefly, we haven't really talked about the music, which is by a composer, Nicholas Britell. I thought it was interesting. It's not music that really stands out. There's nothing in there that I think has jumped out at me so far, but it
do they have themes to the characters? Because I have not noticed.
I don't think so. I think they're a little bit for planets. I did see a brief interview with the composer where he talked about coming up with a very specific musical cues for Canary in the flashbacks, because it's not just having a different environment, but he's also, it's like
different sound.
And that this is filtered through Cassian's memory, is him remembering it. So he wanted to make it a little bit more like, not exactly dreamlike, but like have an element of it's being seen through somebody's memory. But I think it, the not standing out is not a bad thing. I mean, we're very used to Star Wars music that does like take front and center, but I think it kind of works with the tone again here.
Oh, no, sorry, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, Dan. But I think to what Tony was saying, right? It helps it make feel a little less Star Warsy because you don't have and less cinematic and just more of a
grounded.
Yes, because you're not looking for those character themes. They may be there, just haven't noticed them at all. Yeah, music's been fine. I haven't. Something I'd like to listen to on its own just to see what it's like, but it's something I have not noticed nearly as much as I think the cinematography or the editing.
Yeah. Cool. Well, there's a lot left to come. Next week, we've got episode 5, possibly a heist, some action. That could be exciting.
Yeah. Pew, pew.
Pew, pew, pew. Pew. We also have, I just want to add, I don't know if we have any plans to cover this, but at the end of the month, there's the Tales of the Jedi animated anthology series will be airing that has
the one about Ahsoka's backstory.
Some of it has Ahsoka. There's some on like Count Dooku's like backstory and Qui-Gon, I think.
Oh, that's cool.
I'll watch that.
Yeah, so we'll probably talk about that at some point. We'll see where we are in our season by that point. But we should wrap up this week's episode. I would, of course, like to thank, as always, my co-host for being here, Tony Sindelar. Always a pleasure.
My pleasure, too. Goodbye, nerds.
Kat Benish, thank you for being here.
Tony, Dan, listeners, always fun.
And, of course, if you would like to reach out to us, you can do so by emailing us at acp@theincomparable.com or hitting us up on Twitter at acp_cast. And
tell
tell
us what you think.
Tell us what you think.
Or any advice on raising children.
Yeah.
send us your questions, your comments. Hey, if you feel so inclined, you can leave a podcast rating over on the Apple Podcast Store. It always helps too. But we'll be back next week. Until then, may the Force be with you.